Okay, we've all had our break. I'd like to welcome everyone back to our debate between Bill Martin and Gwyn Thomas on the subject of where real power lies in capitalism. You heard from Bill Martin before the break. Now I'm going to hand the floor over to Gwyn Thomas, who will make his contribution.
Thank you, comrades. Good afternoon, comrades, friends, fellow workers. I'm aware that it's bad practice to open the meeting by making an apology. Nevertheless, I think I ought to make one now. And that is to apologise for the fact that there's likely to be a certain amount of repetition between what I say and what Bill's already said. This debate format is a fairly new one to our meetings. I certainly can't remember a similar kind of debates in the past 30 years or so. Because normally we debate opponents and we are aware of their case and we put ours in opposition. It's difficult to debate with someone you largely agree with, but nevertheless I'll give it a try. But I assure you that there's been no contrivance between Bill and I. We've not had words as to who's going to say what and who's going to make what points at what time and in what way. Having said that, I'd like to inform you that I have a problem with the use of the word real in this debate. I have difficulty in using the word real in relation to power. I prefer to see power on a scale from that which is less effective and is usually called weakness to where it is more effective and where it is called strength. And history can be seen, Marx tells us, as the history of class struggle. History also records the ebb and flow of power in society and the way in which it's exercised. And like Stan, and I'm pleased to agree with Stan, I also see society as a network. I've seen as a network of powers, and there are four networks at least which we can identify. First is the ideological network, second is the economic, the third is the military, and the fourth is the political. And where we fit in, the United States diplomat Henry Kissinger's contention that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac, I'm not quite sure. There is a danger inherent in playing fast and loose with words and their meanings, so it's usually the policy in the party. It's not laid down anywhere, but it's the party has come to realise that when we try to put across our ideas, we must be clear about what it is we're talking about. So quite often meetings of the Socialist Party and articles in the Socialist Standard and in our other literature usually start off with definitions. And I'll start off with one in answer to the question, what is power? And I'll use the definition that's, I think, fairly commonsensical. It's that power is the possibility of imposing one's will upon the behaviour of other persons. It's a point I should come back to. And in particular, upon those who might, for whatever reason, be reluctant or averse to such imposition. The greater the capacity to impose such will and achieve such purposes, the greater the power. So power then operates in a social context and through the networks which are applied. And it's the social context under discussion here today is the context of this society. Now, for the Socialist Party, capitalism is a system of society which means for producing wealth the land, the factories, the mines, the means of transport, means of education, and so on, are owned and controlled by a fairly small minority of society. The majority of people in capitalist society own no property other than their ability to work, which they must sell to an employer for a wage or a salary. Now, that's basically capitalism. We can expand on it later if we wish. I'd like now to outline three instruments of power. If power is the ability to make others do what the wielder of power wants, what instruments does he or she need? Note, none of the instruments is used exclusively. They are all used in varying combinations at various times. The first and most obvious, the most tangible manifestation of wielding power is physical force. This we may call combined or coercive power, the ability to impose on others a course of action or the adoption of behaviour that is not their first or even not their second or third preference, usually via the threat of punishment or other painful or unpleasant outcome. This is submission of one to another through the threat of adverse consequences. Galley slaves bent over their oars and propelled the galley through the water, not out of choice, but to avoid the discomfort of the lash, should they be seen to be malingering. On the lesser scale, an individual might refrain from speaking for fear of a rebuke. It's a milder form of coercive power. One nation might choose to impose its political will on another by force of arms, by military power, as is currently the case in Iraq. Now, these are obvious in-your-face forms of the exercise of power. But power can be exercised in a second way. Submission can be achieved through the offer of positive or affirmative rewards. This we might call the exercise of compensatory power. In earlier times, submission in the form of work done on the land of another was rewarded by being allowed to keep a portion of what was produced, or by the right to work a piece of land of one's own. In modern capitalist society, submission can be bought by wages. Deprived of the means of production, workers can gain access to food, clothing, and shelter almost exclusively by buying them from someone who owns them. The chattel slave had the lash, the wage slave has his or her wage packet or salary check, or to bring us right up to date, the electronic transfer of a credit into one's bank account. This is usually explained by apologists for capitalism as payment for services rendered. But it is, in fact, the purchase by the employer of the worker's ability to work. Now, this form of power, economic power, is much less in your face. Nevertheless, it is just as real and arguably just as powerful. It can be exercised by those with wealth. Why does the worker submit? Why, in fact, is there a whole class of buyers of labour power and a class of sellers of labour power? Why is it that in order to live, the vast majority have to sell themselves for money, while a privileged minority are able to live off the proceeds of a system of exploitation? The answer lies in the ownership of property, the setup by which one group, the owners, is able to exclude another group, the workers, from access to the means of life, except on conditions that the owners set out and largely control. Private class ownership of the means of wealth production brings with it tremendous power and the ability to accumulate further vast wealth. This in its train brings great disparities in lifestyle and standards of living, both within nations and across the globe. Bill has pointed out decisions regarding what is to be produced, when it is to be produced, on where and in what quantities, all are driven by the need to make a profit. But the owners do not in the main operate the means of production that they own. In today's complex and highly specialized world, such decisions regarding production are made by people hired to do the job. In other words, they are made by members of the working class. In capitalism, to repeat, the employer buys and the worker sells labour power. Clearly, the former has power over the latter, because the conclusion from the means of production, access to the things we need in order to live, leads to deprivation and finally to death. Well, in the exercise of both coercive and compensatory power, the individuals over whom power is exercised are aware of their submission, if only dimly. It is, of course, rarely expressed as boldly as this or in the way I've just outlined and in the terms I've used. Why is this? It is, I suggest, because of the presence in society of a third instrument, that of condition or conditioning power. Coercive power lies on the promise or reality of punishment. Compensatory power relies on the promise or reality of reward. Conditioned power relies on the ability to form and change belief. The individual submits because this is believed to be proper or right. It's not natural, the way things have always been done. Indeed, the only way that things can be done. Conditioned power remains for the most part hidden from view because it is seldom, if ever, examined closely, even by those who benefit from it. It is considered impolite or even ludicrous to raise such matters. This makes it a very effective form of power because those being subjected to it are not aware that it's been exercised. Formal education and informal parental instruction has for generations produced conformity to social norms from which the capitalist class benefits. This conditioning is taken very seriously. Class textbooks never challenge the status quo, never propose alternative political arrangements that really matter. Religion enjoins us to obedience. If this was all there was to it, things would never change and that would be an end to it. We could all pack up now and go home, but please don't. So I want to suggest that all is not lost. The exercise of power, getting others to submit by conditioning, compensation, or coercion, is not a one-way process. It's a dialectical one. The exercise of power almost invariably gives rise to resistance. Sometimes it's only in small ways, the passive resistance represented by petty workplace theft or the throwing of a sickie. At other times, it's an all-out strike or riot in the streets. Our experience of the world as workers leads some of us, socialists, at least to question the way things are and to propose alternatives. Alternative proposed by the Socialist Party is, of course, the establishment of socialism. That is, to dispossess the owning class of their ownership of wealth, their control of the means by which we all must live, and the power that goes with it. To do this, we must ask, what keeps the wealthy in their positions of power and privilege. Because make no mistake about it, that is what they have. I've alluded to one thing already, the widely held belief that class ownership and privilege is somehow natural, something that cannot be changed without bringing the whole universe down around our ears. The second thing goes to the nub of this debate. It is that while the ownership of wealth certainly confers power and privilege on the owners, that ownership is underwritten and guaranteed through the exercise of political power. As some people believe that wealth or property is the underlying source of power. But property is itself a form of authority created by governments. In Britain, in Europe and the United States, indeed, through most of the developed world, the owning class are confirmed in their ownership and power on a regular basis by working class votes. Now, I'm aware that there are parts of the world where what I've said doesn't strictly apply, and there are parts of the world which are ruled by military juntas, military dictatorships. Nevertheless, in the world as a whole, I would say that what I've just described is the way things are. Votes are sought by promises that the candidate or his or her party will do something for it. Workers vote for representatives committed to maintaining capitalism, no matter what form the words they use, to gain support at the polls. In doing so, workers forego the possibility of organising for socialism. That is, to organise consciously and politically to gain control of the state machine, the machinery of government and the armed forces, so that the means of production may be converted from being the property of a minority class and made the common property of the whole of humankind. Some might argue, indeed some have argued, that power, or rather real power, whatever the difficulties associated with using that word, real power lies outside the state apparatus I've outlined. Now, if this were so, we as a political organisation would be wasting our time. Socialism would not be established by a conscious majority taking hold of the state machine and converting it from an instrument of class rule into a means of political and economic emancipation. Why not? Because it's argued that is not where the power lies. Real power lies elsewhere. And as Bill has explained, we may explore a greater detail later in questions. But if economic power or wealth trumps political power, how is the working class ever to dispossess the owning class and establish common ownership? In other words, according to opponents of my proposition, we are wasting our time. I don't believe that is the case. I don't believe that those that argue that real power lies outside elected bodies is the case. Don't be fooled by the braying that goes on in Prime Minister's question time. That is a sideshow. Certainly in the United Kingdom, in most of the advanced nations, there are organisations, elected bodies, set up to oversee and run capitalism. They make the laws and they provide for their enforcement. And that is what the working class need to concentrate on before they can establish socialism. I've spoken for about 20 minutes. I've got a little more to say, but
regarding the origins of modern day power structures, but I think I'll leave it there. Thank you, comrades.
Yes, Jack.
We heard of network webs and phishing and bad systems, and I wonder, when I was at work involved in trade union work, we were digging our heels in against the social trade in local government, which was making the working conditions worse for us. And I did find that the person, the manager, was liked and kind and pleasant. He actually managed to push through measures and changes, which generally people were against, simply because his personality was acceptable, generally wasn't. And I wonder how you feel about the fact that psychology comes into an awful lot of how we act, how we behave, and how we're brought up. And where does this expression forced consciousness fit in nowadays to the argument, which I seem to have read to do with Marx somewhere or other?
Sorry, what consciousness?
False
consciousness. Janet asked a question about psychology, which I'm in no position to answer. I've not studied psychology, apart from, you know, very lightweight idiot's guide. The question of false consciousness is explained, I think, by the fact that, as Bill explained, the workers come to the world and experience the world through a filter of received ideas. These ideas are those ideas that are in the main in the interests of the owning class. Before the bourgeoisie came to power, they first had to work out a theory which justified their actions. And in Britain, it was a very, very serious one. They killed the king. God's representative on earth was murdered. They did that because they became aware of their real position in society. They saw their interests as being in opposition to other interests. And the only way that their interests could be furthered was by taking that action. Now, our argument is that workers' experience of the world they live in, they start questioning, which many workers do, they will eventually see that the situation that they find themselves in is caused by a system that is run in the interests of others, in the interests of a class to which they don't belong. They'll come to the socialist conclusion, hopefully sooner than later, but that needs to be changed. They will have gained socialist revolutionary political consciousness.
Michael?
I think the problem today is regarding the power. The working class is unity, one of the most important. The capitalists use the divide and rule among workers, the high paid, the low paid, and different. They use religion, ethnicity. That's why they try to create a division among the working class. But if the working class is united, class conscious, the capitalist class could not do anything, because we do the dirty work, we do the fighting, even in the Gulf War. The American working class and the Iraqi working class have one in common, the capitalist class. The Iraqi capitalists and the American have one in common, because the class conscious is the most important to defeat the power of the ruling class. But as I said, there is a divide and rule among workers. There is a precondition workers to unite. That's the most important, you know, why socialism has not advanced so far. That's in my opinion.
Comments on that, Will?
No, I haven't got anything to come back on that, sorry.
Yeah. Anybody else like to ask a question or make a comment?
Yeah. A question. I listened to what Bill had to say about the topic for debate. I've listened to Gwynne. I've heard a lot of, different interpretations of capitalism. What I'm not clear about is, are there any points that either Bill or Gwynne actually disagree with each other about?
I don't. Bill mentioned, I made a note of a couple of things. Bill says mentions the control of the states. It's the control of the state that enables capitalists to rule, which I think concedes my point. Talked about the need to take control of the state again, which is conceding my point. And then he mentioned constitutional innovations, which the current American Prime Minister has made. Of course, that is the exercise of real political power, if you like. It's the power to alter the rules under which capitalism is run.
Well, I would say that my interpretation of what I was put forward was that capitalist class control the state because of their relative wealth and position, and not because they control the state, which is, to my mind, more or less the anarchist position. Anarchists say the capitalist class exists because of the state. We abolish the state, we abolish capitalism. To my mind, it's the problem lies in the inequality in society, which gives them privileged access to the means of coordinating society, and that in the course of the struggle of social power, that is an advantage but not the determining and final, and that they've already essentially lost, that the real power lies with us if we exercise it, but that at the present moment it remains a vital and useful part of their way of controlling them, and in fact remains the last vestige, if you like, of capitalist influence in society. Now, the capitalists do not necessarily directly control the means of production and industry. They have work proxies to do that for them. So the difference is possibly one of how many angels dance at the head of a pig, because the effect is, I think, the same. But it's a matter of is the taking control of Parliament the first act, or is it the second? Is it the final act, more or less? Do we win when we take control of the state, or do we win the battle and then take control of the state, essentially by having control of the balance of social forces? I suppose in it might or might not matter. In some senses, I mean, I'll put it like this. In the 1920s, an article in the Social Standard writing about Mussolini says, of course, we despise and hate him, but look what you can do when you've got the army on your side. And essentially there was this thinking in the party that obviously the socialist reformer government, they'd have the army on their side and the state would make socialism. And that's certainly, I think, possibly some of the Camden and North West London branch members veered towards that sort of interpretation of DOP. And it's this difference of potential for substitution in the argument that says that the state is also class rule, rather than saying class rule is the source of preponderance in the means of authority. But perhaps it is a very obscure mind of it, but certainly I thought it was worth, you know, having a discussion, at least to find out how much common ground there is in the party, and to, you know, examine things perhaps more than just one point of view as our normal case.
I'm wondering if we could actually hold questions on the, maybe addressed to both speakers until after a short break that we're going to have, where we're going to take a collection. Are there any questions specifically for Gwynne? Yes.
An exactly question to add to statement of fact. 30 years ago when I said this at young socialist meetings, even the Labour Party meetings, I nearly got hammered. Everybody here is a slave. They were born slaves and brought up as slaves. Very sad fact, but the true fact. The Queen is a slave too. She is what the African calls the Kaigama, the noble slave. How are you all enslaved? You are enslaved from 1694 by the privatization of the Bank of England. If you want to be a slave and pay the cost of your own slavery, let the banks create the money. The banks have been creating money out of nothing, thin air, and enslaving every one of you. Let me control the issue of a nation's currency. I cannot do righteous laws. That's against the chairman of the Bank of England. Two people. Now, coming to your country, in the United States, everything and everybody is owned by private bankers. Lock, stock, and barrel. there's no such thing as democracy. It's absolute farce. You don't live in a democracy. You live in a totalitarian, tripartite dictatorship. I didn't say that. Lord Hailsham said that. He's no better than I do. Right? So the only way, if you ever want to achieve anything in life, is to take charge of the control and issue of money. That is the fundamental thing that rules all of our lives, from the day you are born until you are died. You won't achieve that here, no way. Because you'll, as I said, you'll have been enslaved. You poor enslavers can't do a thing about it. Fortunately, the message is getting across the world. When I challenged the leader of a country, he told the biggest money lender, the IMF and the World Bank, you beggars are not fit to run a pigsty. Don't you ever tell a democratically elected leader of a country how to conduct his monetary and fiscal policies. And we gave them the solution how to do it. You wouldn't get to hear any of the chancellors of the United Kingdom or the United States or Germany or any of the G8 countries ever telling the money lenders to go to hell. No. Until you can do that, and if you all want a solution, we'll give you a solution. Simple as that. Otherwise, you're like killing yourself. The last 30 years we've been killing, like killing yourself and killing others. Very sad.
Interesting point of view. Is that something you'd like to comment on, Mike?
Well, yes, a couple of things. I mean, the idea that banks create money out of nothing, I think is a mistaken one.
Pardon? It's a mistake.
I believe it is to be a mistaken one that banks create
I'm
money.
How rude are you?
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt your comment, your contribution. Please have the decency to allow me to finish. We can disagree, but at least let us know what it is to disagree at that. Yes, I think the idea that banks create money out of nothing is. I mean, certainly they can print money. They can print money to their heart's content, but that only leads to inflation if it's not a bank backed by gold in their vault. The other thing is, I would question the assertion that everything is owned by banks. Well, I don't think that even that is true. Shares are bought and sold on the stock exchange. I mean, I could go out, should I feel the desperate urgency, and buy a few shares. Not very many, but I could do that. The business about the control and issue of money is really of no relevance to the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party is out to produce a condition of social affairs where money becomes unnecessary. When you have common ownership, you don't need money, which is a means of exchange. And as for all of us being slaves, well, yes, we're all wage slaves, but some of us are conscious of the fact, and I would point to the historical fact that slaves do and have revolted.
Actually, there are other people who want to speak. So, the issue that you raised, basically the issue of social credit, is something that the party has dealt with in the past. I'm not sure how relevant it is actually to this day, but if you are interested in the party's arguments and critique of the issue of whether banks create money, there is a great deal of party literature that I'm sure any member could refer you. But we'll hold that for after the after question. So you at the back, you had a question.
Not so much a question, it's not a comment. It was just a comment on the chap at the front was mentioning having conceived himself as a slave, born a slave, and everybody else in the shop was also called equally a slave. To him, that may well be true. But I think even slaves have a duty to respect the laws of the land which they're slaves in. And I think also to say that I made a slave to the system, I'm born a slave, that may well be true, but unless you can give me alternative means to enjoy my slave life, then it's probably wise to be personal to yourself, because I may not choose to want to accept that, because I'm not given a direction which to enjoy life, if that makes sense.
Are there any further comments on Gwyn's statement? Okay then, we'll take a shred in the collection, just say 5 minutes or so, and we'll reconvene just for some brief concluding comments and concluding questions. So if
Can I borrow somebody's hat? Bill's hat? It does cost us money to hold these meetings, so any contributions would be... Any contributions would be very much appreciated.